Hey there, foreigners. This is Rohit from BreakingTheBorders.com, home of the ambitious immigrants. Today's guest is Jason Finkelman from FinkelmanLaw.com. If you're a long-time listener, you might notice that Jason has been on the show earlier. The first time he was on, we talked about a certain category of visas called the extraordinary ability visas, which seem to be highly utilized by the immigrant entrepreneurs community. And in today's interview, he's here to talk about the H-1B visa category and what are some of the changes that are coming to that program under the new administration. So, Jason, welcome to Breaking the Borders podcast.
Thank you for having me back, Rohit. It's always a pleasure chatting with you.
Thanks for coming on. So, let's dive right in. What is H-1B visa? What are the basics of it? And what does one need to do to get one? And who is it applicable for? Can you just give us the intro to H-1B visa for someone who is not familiar?
Absolutely. So, the H-1B non-immigrant visa generally is a temporary non-immigrant visa in the U.S. that allows a foreign national to work for up to 3 years initially, plus a three-year extension thereafter for a maximum of 6 years. The general requirements are that a foreign national has a U.S. employer who is going to sponsor them to work in a job that, at a minimum, requires a bachelor's degree to perform, and that the foreign national has a bachelor's degree that's related to the position they're going to be performing. Each year on the first Monday of April, this year it'll be April 3rd, U.S. Citizenship and Immigration Services, USCIS, makes available 85,000 H-1B visa applications for everyone in the world to apply for. If the foreign national gets one of those petitions approved, their visa becomes active to use on October 1st. So April 3rd apply, October 1st you get the visa. What's happened in the last 5 or 6 years is that USCIS receives in excess of 85,000 H-1B visa petitions on the very first day that those visas become available. And what they do is they say, okay, we're going to only take, usually it's the visa submitted during the first week of April. We're going to take all those that we've received and put them in a computer-generated lottery system. We're going to let a computer select at random the 85,000 H-1B visas that we'll then hand process to see if they're approvable. Those that aren't selected are returned back to their employer. You know, try again another year. Sorry, you didn't get it. Mm-hmm. Everyone's weighted the same in that lottery. Doesn't matter whether you're working for the Google, the Facebooks, or small startup company, or it doesn't matter your nationality or the job you're performing.
Which state you're applying from? Does that matter or not really?
Doesn't matter where you're, what country you're applying from. Everyone is weighted the same. Now, there's one small caveat in that lottery, which is to say individuals who have a U.S. master's degree or higher, what they do is out of that 85,000 H-1B visas they make available, they set aside 20,000 for those that have a U.S. master's degree or higher. They'll run a separate lottery for those individuals. Those individuals with a U.S. master's degree or higher that aren't selected actually get a second chance to play with the remaining 65,000 H-1B visas. So those with a U.S. master's degree or higher have slightly better odds in the H-1B visa lottery, so to speak.
Yeah, I've been working on H-1B visa for more than 5 years now. And when I graduated, I really had a hard time finding a job because in 2010, it was not the best of the times for finding jobs because we were just out of a recession. And I used to really have a curse the timing of my graduation. But looking back, I feel like it's a blessing in some way because back then, the H-1 wouldn't get over on the first day. So, because there were not enough jobs available in the market, so it seems to be like a blessing in some form.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's what I say to people, you know, in years where the economy is bad, you know, there were H-1B visas available all the way until June or July in some cases. And there wasn't that cap that was met in the first day. But when the economy is strong, as I highly anticipate will be the case this year in 2017, I think that we'll have a lottery again this year.
So we talked about a lot of visas for the co-founders, right? Like EB visas, O visas, and so on. But we didn't talk about H-1B. Actually, for someone who wants to listen to the earlier interview. It's available at breakingtheborders.com/Jason, J-A-S-O-N. But for now, Jason, how does a co-founder apply for an H-1B visa? Because you mentioned that it's an employer giving the visa to an employee. You need to have an employer. But if you're a co-founder, how does that work?
Yeah, it's a very sensitive issue because, as you and probably many of your listeners already know, the U.S. immigration system as it is today is quite an antiquated U.S. immigration system. And it doesn't really take into consideration how we work today in a modern society with startups and entrepreneurs and co-founders and things like that. And so the law itself for H-1B visa purposes says to have a U.S. employer sponsoring you for this H-1B visa, that U.S. employer has to show ownership and control of the U.S. company, mm-hmm. and that they control the foreign national as an employee. So, you know, ownership for H-1B visa purposes technically is 51%. So requires that there is a U.S. or a lawful permanent resident holder that is not the foreign national that owns at least 51% of the U.S. entity that's going to be sponsoring the foreign national, mm-hmm. and that they the U.S. company controls the foreign national, meaning they tell the foreign national when to come to work, you know, when they can go to lunch, when they can take vacation, what they wear. Yeah. That's a really, really important part of the H-1B visa process, especially for startups, and especially where there is smaller startups where a co-founder may be involved in the process. That's something I've seen in the last year or two USCIS really try to hone in on is, I don't know, is there really ownership and control here for this U.S. entity? Or does this foreign national have some ownership or have some control? If so, that won't fly for H-1B purposes.
So if there are three founders and two of them are Americans and one is an immigrant, that is okay because if they're equal partners, let's say 33%, 33%, 33%, because the majority of the stake is still with American citizens. But how does it work when there are two founders and one of them is an American and one is an immigrant?
Yeah, when there's two, it really does have to have an American person own at least 51%. Right. Because if that foreign national has 50 or more, then USCIS is going to argue, well, they have the ability to control the H-1B relationship, and that's not what the H-1B visa is. It's an employer-sponsored visa, and the employee can't self-sponsor themselves under the H-1B visa.
I see. So if you were to go into the nitty-gritty, how does one apply for H-1 visa, either for themselves or one of their employees? I'm confusing between employer and employee, but if I have a company and I want to sponsor an immigrant on the H-1, what are the steps to take?
So the first step in the process is identifying who the foreign national that needs sponsorship. The second step there is what's called the Labor Condition Application, LCA step. One of the misnomers about the H-1B visa program generally is that it's this cheap labor program, which it's not. Basically, the U.S. Department of Labor steps in the process really early on and says, hey, look, we, the U.S. Department of Labor, are going to tell you, U.S. employer, what you must pay at a minimum to this foreign national for that position. Mm-hmm. And we do that by doing these wage surveys in each geographic region of the country. So we can tell you, for example, in San Francisco, a software developer makes at a minimum $75,000 a year. I'm making that up right now. Mm-hmm. Therefore, you, U.S. employer, must pay this foreign national no less than $75,000. That process, that labor condition application, has to be filed with the Department of Labor, has to be done early enough in the process, and usually I tell employers this right now. Right now is sort of the peak time to start the H-1B visa process because there's several prerequisite filing steps which must be done prior to the H-1B being filed on April 3rd. So this labor condition application has to be filed first. It takes some time to get certified. Meanwhile, they're pulling together the foreign national's documents, academic credentials, to show that the foreign national has a bachelor's degree or higher related to the position. They're showing why the U.S. position that they're going to hire the foreign national qualifies as a job that at a minimum requires a bachelor's degree. Mm-hmm. And they bring all that together and file the H-1B visa on April 3rd.
I see. So does the applicant have to be, they can be anywhere, right? They don't have to be in the U.S.
They can be anywhere. Yeah, they don't have to be here in the U.S. By and large, what happens, and this is really sort of an important caveat for students, because oftentimes a lot of students are graduating from U.S. universities and finding H-1B visa employers. They may be eligible under what's something called the OPT, Optional Practical Training CAP-GAP extension, if they have employment authorization now in the U.S., mm-hmm. that may expire before October 1st when that H-1B visa becomes active. If their visa petition is selected in the lottery, they can take their USCIS receipt notice to their school and extend their employment authorization here in the U.S. To continue working for their employer until October 1st. But if you're outside the U.S., yeah, you may be eligible to have a U.S. employer file for an H-1B visa for you as well.
I see. So if someone who is in outside the U.S. or even within the U.S., if they want to go through this process right now, you are saying now is the best time to start?
Yeah, it's really critical to start, no later than the second week of March, because what happens is someone may call, me, for example, on the third or fourth week of March and say, okay, we're ready to start the H-1B visa process for this foreign national. But I'm going to say, well, because of this labor condition application, which we talked about, which takes time to be a process with the Department of Labor, because it takes time to prepare these applications, if you start this process by the third or fourth week of March, it's usually too late because you're not going to get the application into USCIS timely on April 3rd. So, it's already getting sort of late in the game now, but the time to pull the trigger is really no later than the second week of March in order to get everything into USCIS timely to play in this, what we think will be a lottery this year.
Got it. So let's talk about some of the proposed changes. So what are some of the changes that the new administration has been proposing to this H-1 rule?
Yeah, that's sort of the interesting thing that we're hearing right now is all the different proposed changes from not only the administration, but from Congress people about, quote unquote, protecting American workers and trying to make the H-1B visa program a little harder. As of today, there is no change to the H-1B visa program. I do not expect there to be any changes between now and April 3rd that will impact this year's H-1B visa program, which should be the same as it has been in years past. That said, the proposed legislation ranges from, increasing that prevailing wage requirement, which is the minimum wage to pay the foreign national, to making it the H-1B visa program harder for only individuals with advanced degrees. And the executive order that is proposed right now, that it hasn't been signed, has very vague language in it that says we're going to direct the Department of Homeland Security to make all work visa programs to protect American workers and students and things like that. Mm-hmm. So everything right now is just proposed, and I get calls daily by people who are really concerned, and rightly so, mm-hmm. by what they hear about not only changes to the H-1B visa program, but to all work visa programs. At this point in time, it's all speculation.
I see.
But it is something that I think we all have on our radar, and we do see, based on the rhetoric of this administration, changing to make work visa programs, I think, more challenging for foreign nationals.
I see. So it sounds like we can expect more scrutiny or more eyes on this year's H-1B process to see what can be changed for next
year. That's actually a really, really good point. And that's what I am telling people across the board, whether it's H-1B visas or O-1s or L-1s or E-investor visas. Look, We've seen in the last 4 or so weeks that this president has been in office a sea change in terms of immigration.
Yeah.
And while all programs are what they are now, and which is what they have been in the past, I think, in my personal opinion, USCIS officers are now emboldened to look at all immigration petitions with a stricter eye. I think it's a different environment now, and people need to work with the most qualified counsel they can to prepare the strongest petition they can to see that it's approved, because I think these officers are now just more emboldened to be stricter on visa applications and petitions than they were in the past.
I see. Yeah, that makes sense. And also, in the course of four years of the new administration, I believe the ideology kind of spreads, right? So I'm worried that it might progressively get harder, even if there is no rule change as such, because the culture and so on tends to have its effect.
Absolutely. Yeah, I see that is a real possibility, especially when you have these vague executive orders that this isn't the case right now, but could be the case, where they say, you know, I, as the president, direct the Department of Homeland Security, which USCIS falls underneath, to do everything in their power to protect American workers and jobs. So that vague language really is a directive to embolden those officers to be stricter when reviewing applications. So again, while those who may be listening say, oh, an H-1B visa, it wasn't so hard in, you know, 2010 or 2012 or 2015 or 2016, I think the writing is on the wall right now for starting with this year's H-1B visas and going forward, that officers will take a firmer and stricter view of adjudicating H-1B.
Yeah, you should certainly do a follow-up once there is any changes or if there is any change either in the culture, the tone, or in actual rule to see what has actually changed. So let's switch gears a little bit here, Jason. We talked about an international entrepreneur rule last time when we had in the first interview. Very quickly, what that rule is, it was a rule passed by the White House in September, which helps give international entrepreneurs a two-year status. And it was a status of parole. So all you need to do is collect enough documentation, take a flight and show up in the country with all those documentation. You don't have to go to the consulate, I believe, right? And based on this paperwork, you get a two-year status. And this was a quick way to form a new visa category, or the new visa category was not formed, and this was done as a shortcut as such, right?
Yeah, sort of. The International Entrepreneur Rule was proposed and actually passed by the last president, President Obama, to provide parole, which is not status and is not a visa in the U.S. It essentially is a piece of paper that would provide certain foreign national entrepreneurs with work authorization, temporary work authorization in the U.S. if they met certain investment thresholds and they were coming to run an entity as an entrepreneur. The current administration, as many of you have probably heard in the news, has made it a point to say that he wants to do away with all of President Obama's executive actions. If that's the case, one of the president's executive actions was this international entrepreneur rule, which was a limited, I think, rule that would, again, not provide a visa, not provide status, it would just provide this work authorization in the U.S. But I think President Trump will probably do away with that international entrepreneur rule.
Yeah.
I don't know, but I think so. And if that's the case, that option will soon be off the table.
Like you said, it was a difficult option to begin with, because one of the things that was needed, I believe, was the financial document of your investor, which may be hard to get in the first place.
Yeah, that was a big one, and showing that the investor had invested, you know, millions of dollars in other entities previously. It was a very limited option,
yeah.
But I expect that to
Again, if someone wants to get details of that, they can go to breakingtheborders.com/Jason for the first round of the interview, where he speaks at length about international entrepreneur role. So finally, Jason, let's talk about travel. If someone is on H-1 visa, what are some of the things that they can do to make their travel smooth? Or first of all, do you recommend if people have any need that they can travel, or is it better to not do so?
Yeah, great question, and a fluid question that seems to be changing every day. And as we record this at the sort of towards the end of February, who knows what the rule will be by the time people listen to this, you know, a day, 5 days, a week from now. Yeah. But the general guidance I give to all my clients right now is, again, it's a different environment than it was 4 weeks ago. If you're an international person traveling to the U.S. on an H-1B visa, on a tourist visa, or even with your green card, it's just a stricter environment. So what I advise all of my clients to do right now, whether you're on an H-1B visa, whether you're from one of the previously banned countries, whether you're from a friendly country, quote unquote, so to speak, is always travel with a proof of your non-immigrant intent, which is your intent to return back to your home country. Mm. Things like apartment lease or a home deed or car title or bank statements or affidavits from friends, things like that. But now, I would say to any international person traveling, even with an H-1B visa or an L-1 or O-1 or E or any type of visa, is travel with proof of your intent to return back to your job here in the U.S. So, you know, a letter from your employer saying, you know, Mr. or Mrs. X is currently employed at our company. He or she traveled, you know, for several weeks on business or for pleasure, and they're returning back. Travel with pay stubs, you know, copies of your last pay stubs, maybe your apartment lease here, your car, your U.S. bank statements, and just keep that in your bag. Look, by and large, do I think an officer, when you come back on an H-1B visa, or L or O or E or even a B, is going to give you a hard time? No. But do I think that officers now have a more of a chance to ask and question about those or feeling, again, emboldened to do that? Yes, I do. And so to have in your carry-on backpack a small little file of your, you know, last pay stubs or your letter can help put that officer at ease to know that you're truly coming back to work in your H-1B visa petition, your H-1B visa position, and that there's no sort of funny business going on, which, as we know, by and large isn't the case. But yeah, that's the environment we live in today in February 2017.
Yeah, we basically have to travel like you're attending a visa interview at any time.
Yeah, you're right, and it's sad and it's unfortunate. And you know, like I hope, as I'm sure many of your listeners know, there are a lot of people, myself included, that are advocating on behalf of all international immigrants, entrepreneurs, to make sure that this country does continue to bring in the best and brightest global talent and to make the U.S. a welcoming country for those people who are here to work and grow and bring stuff to this country that makes this country survive. And that's all we can hope will continue to be the case.
Thanks for that information, Jason. So if someone wants to get in touch with you. So actually, I want to ask you a slightly different question. So I know you do help with filing H-1s and so on, but I'm curious to know, I get a lot of requests for a consultation. So if they have a quick question about something, do you do consultations, and what is the best place for people to find you?
I do, and I'm glad you said that. So I'll tell people how they can reach out to me. But first, I encourage everyone to call me, email me, reach out to me with any question they have anytime. It is so much easier for me, and it usually takes 5 or 10 minutes for me to answer anyone's question and let them know either A, there's options, or B, there's no options, and they don't need to contact anyone else, than it is for a person to spend 20, 30, 60 minutes on the internet finding information that can oftentimes be false. So I encourage any of your listeners to feel free to give me a call anytime. It's my greatest pleasure to answer anyone's questions that they have. Yeah. People can contact me several ways through my website, which is finkelmanlaw.com, spelled finkelmanlaw.com. I'm also at Twitter and Facebook at Finkelman Law. You can directly email me at Jason, J-A-S-O-N, at finkelmanlaw.com. And my phone number is 512-348-8855. And anyone can call me directly on that number at my office anytime. Genuinely, I mean it, because especially in this environment, people are scared and they're concerned and there's a lot of misinformation. So yeah, the least I can do is help people get their questions answered.
Yeah. Yeah, I second that you're very responsive, Jason. Actually, I'm not used to lawyers being so responsive, to be honest. I've worked with many lawyers in the last 5-8 years, and I don't hear back from lawyers so quickly as I did from you. You're very tech-savvy, a modern-age lawyer, I would say.
Well, that's very nice, and I appreciate that compliment. Like I say to people, I come from a family of immigrants, and so I love what I do. I have a passion for what I do, and I know what people's concerns are when they're coming here, and their lives at stake and their families' lives at stake. So, like I say, the least I can do is make myself available to answer people's questions.
Great. Thanks, Jason. Thank you so much for joining us today.
My pleasure. Thank you, Roy.
Thank you for tuning in. To get updates on latest episodes, make sure you subscribe with your email by going over to breakingtheborders.com. If you know anyone good as a guest, shoot me an email. I will reach out to the guest, get hold of them, and ask them all the questions that you have. My email is rohit@breakingtheborders.com. Thanks again, and have an amazing day.